the three things we have are action packed tonight for you. So tonight is our reading for the Emerging Writer Spotlight Award. So we'll have all the winners from the undergraduate and graduate categories. So this award, the Jerome Street Distinguished Writer Series Spotlight Award, is to be given to two fiction writers, two nonfiction writers, and two poets, one undergraduate student and one graduate student in each genre, and at Florida State University each spring semester. The award is open to all undergraduates who participated in creative writing coursework and the university and graduate students in the creative writing program. Winners this year were selected in each genre by nationally recognized judges, David Shields and Kevin Prufer. Alright, my first reader is coming from the Honorable Mention in the Undergraduate Poetry category. This will be Sasha Rizzo reading Action Potential. Sasha is a junior here at FSU and is currently working toward her BA in creative writing. She has been published previously in the Quincy Review, FSU's undergraduate literary journal, and hopes to continue writing and publishing in the future. Stealing her needs from you. We grew up with parents who didn't believe in anything, not even you. So faith has boxed the twisted thing clinging against the crater of your chest, unlit. She surrenders the seventh day to resting her hands in a holy tangle, and you fill it hemming innocence. The bit before love became a prayer that meant breaking. You say, historically speaking, a faggot is a cluster of sticks used to kindle fire. So what more is a burning bush than an anthology of distant limbs? When in flames, God and gaze glow the same, and she confesses, I'm going to hell because I love you. She can't tell in heresy. Here, say it, and I'm hollowed you, her shepherd of boundless loyalty. The last time you read her knees, they are bending away from you, at the right angles that say, you are right about the Exodus, about the gossamer bruises that rape them. Before I'm done dying, I kneel in the dining room like a prayer. Let it lead my hungry knees downstairs to the basement of my brain, where I break it into a careful swallower of collarbones and swords and words. Blood unspools and sighs for a spine, a pulse, a calculated spoonful of moths unpinned from my palms and shivering towards a different kind of lightness. This morning, the sun forgot to bruise and the birds didn't hum, and my teeth opened like a broken zipper and rusted every second of my skin. And it's not that I wish the rest of the world would suffer. I just want to watch it tongue the salt from its own ocean wounds before I drift back up the steps and dissolve in the living room. This year's Pushcart Prize Special Mention, and a finalist for the Beckshire and Levi's Prize. His poems have appeared in the Best New Poets, Plume, the Colorado Review, Lit Hub, and elsewhere.
Thanks for being here. So I'm just going to, like, punch. For an American daughter, I have no idea why a boy would hold his fist an inch from the yellow jacket burrow at the base of a telephone pole, an M80 in his grip, and egg another boy on to light it. He dropped the hissing explosive in, and they both whooped away, dirt and insects spraying like BBs with the boom behind them. And the pole nodded slightly, a frightened approval that impressed 8-year-old me across the street. There was something, it seemed, to loving fire, more than the grace of cells stacked on cells, insect colony, or bones and muscle and skin. Bang is simpler than hum, and therefore, to a boy taught by America, more beautiful. Rage is simpler than loneliness. When the air had calmed enough, the boys crept in to assess their damage, which was hardly noticeable, which the remaining hive would soon repair, which angered the boys deeply. Any failure to a boy raised on America can become a string of teeth chattering around his neck. And so can any hope. I say this because such a boy can make of anything a nest to hold his longing. I say this so you won't be fooled. A hand, a hole, camaraderie built on spending your pooled and only dollars on a tube with fuse, nests. Never carry someone else's longing. Thanks.
Thank you.
So next up, we have another honorable mention in the graduate poetry category, which is Paige Lewis's Last Night I Dreamed I Made Myself. Paige Lewis is the author of the chapbook Reasons to Wake You from Tupelo Press 2018. Their poems have appeared in Poetry, American Poetry Review, Plowshares, The Georgia Review, Best New Poets 2017, and elsewhere.
He said that he buried his right eye in South Georgia on a dare, he said, when he was little, beneath one green ash of two that marked the end of a road whose name he's by now forgotten, lonesome something, maybe dog or cricket. He said he couldn't love me, not really, not without his old right eye. Anyway, he'd left his tongue as a tip, slid under a mug at a small North Florida diner, would collect it too along the way, seeing as he'd asked the server to save it, and she had kindly agreed. Three of his ribs were further gone, one in Wisconsin where he planted it like a tree, though he believed even then nothing would bloom on it. Another he pawned in Manitoba for a silver bracelet, which he wore only when he was very sad. And his last rib he'd been keeping in a safety deposit box in a credit union on the alien Oregon coast, where he'd visit sometimes, stopping off in Advantages to take in expanses of pines covered in moss and something else, like brine. And the pines were tall, tall and uncommunicating, as if they had been designed only to listen. His ears he'd left with me. I told them everything, words I had invented for the color of new moons, city names I had given to four slender ant colonies that had since emerged on the lawn. I told the ears, come back to me, but they were unable to relay these types of
things. And anyway, there was nothing else to do. I took all my littlest veins and pitched them as a woven tightrope out of the kitchen window and hooked with a makeshift grapple the cheek of the visible moon, which carried me away. And I was sorry to have wounded it like that. And I was sorry to be carried by what I had wounded. Thank you.
Fiction category with our undergraduate nonfiction winner. So this is Melanie Raybon for Exodus. Melanie Jade Raybon is a senior undergraduate studying editing, writing, and media and minoring in women's studies. She loves Chuck Palahniuk, cuddling with her cat Fitz, and singing Stevie Nicks songs. She hopes to work for a publishing house someday. The same amount of time as a woman carries her child. Three raps of his brazen knuckles on the glass coffee table in front of us, louder than expected, leaves a fleshy smudge mark that my grandmother would have been horrified by. I immediately wiped the transgression away. You have 1 hour to leave Cuba, Pablo booms, deepening the bass in his already baritone voice, in an attempt to impersonate the authoritative officers of Fidel Castro's regime. In their army green caps and matching work boots, with soles thicker than the skull of a human head, the two men had stood in the doorway of Ernesto's cramped Havana apartment. 9 months after he had applied for 4 spots on the Freedom Flights and consequently been forced to quit his job, they had finally come to announce the approval for the Frades family's departure from Cuba, reading off the names one by one. Ernesto, Lourdes, Alejandro, Mercedes. Lourdes had listened anxiously from behind the kitchen wall, cuddling her 10-day-old baby as a pot of rice boiled over on the stove. 30 years and one American man later, and that baby would become my mom. She sits beside me now, 2 children and no mother, passively listening to the story of her exodus from the country in which she was born. She has not been back since. 9 meses, and finally they allowed us to leave. Of course, I had to pack para tu tío y tu madre, all their things, and we put everything inside, solo dos maletas, 2 suitcases, no more, because there was not room, they told us. Abel's English, unlike my deceased grandmother's, has only gotten better with age, but he still slips into the familiarity of his native tongue every now and then. He knows I understand. He taught my sister and I to understand Spanish better than any high school teacher ever could. And so, we had to say goodbye to everyone we knew, i.e. to her family, y yo, mi hermano, y mis padres. They had all stood out on the street lined with brightly colored apartments, identical to Ernesto's own pale yellow one, crying and hugging each other, unsure when they might meet again. Only Ernesto's brother was dry-eyed, believing himself to be next on the list for asylum in Los Estados Unidos. In a month's time, he would be forced onto a truck full of other Castro dissenters, heading for a sugar farm, where he would labor under the sweltering island sun, cutting cane for no pay, until he was finally given a spot on one of the promised flights to Miami International Airport. Así que, we had to leave. They took us away from Havana to a sort of processing place, lleno de gente. So many people, como un can of sardines. Abel laughs the way he does, when, always does, when he expects that he's told a good joke. My mother smiles softly, her unengaged eyes focused on the wall just behind my grandfather. The portrait of Ayi hangs there, her eyes almost identical to her daughter's, her face youthful and pretty. The Frades family stayed in the processing facility for 24 hours, the baby girl crying at Lourdes' breast through most of the night, her 7-year-old brother begging to be taken back home for dinner, breakfast, lunch. Members of the government had been at work throughout the day and night, digging through Ernesto's and Lourdes' histories to ensure they would not be a hazard to America. They needed a reason, any reason, to keep the four on the island, to try and put one tiny dent in the mass immigration of Cubans fleeing from communism. Success came in the form of Lourdes' father, a reserved local judge who had made one too many subtle comments about Fidel Castro. They sent an order a la oficina where he worked, to the court. He was to be arrested, or perhaps matado, porque sometimes they did that. Abel's thick gray eyebrows raise, and his mouth droops into a frown, shrugging his shoulders, desensitized to the notion of his father-in-law being murdered as a political dissident. Papi, my mother's voice rings out with surprise. She's given up her trance and now eyes my grandfather sharply. Yo no sabía eso, nunca me dijiste. Bueno, sí, mi amor. He evades the accusation prevalent in his daughter's tone. I wonder if perhaps he avoided telling her until my grandmother had gone, because Ayi did not like to relive this part. He clears his throat loudly and continues. Pero, someone inside of the court saw the order and stopped it before him because they knew that we were leaving. I try to imagine how different my reality might be if that order had been carried through. My grandparents most likely would have been forced to stay behind, maybe would have been accused of dissidence, my grandfather perhaps facing jail or a labor camp. My mother would have grown up on the island and married a nice Cuban man instead of a nice American one. I would be singing along to Celia Cruz and Pitbull instead of Stevie Nicks and Drake, eating lechon asado con arroz at every meal instead of macaroni and cheese, driving a 1954 Toyota Land Cruiser instead of a 2002 Nissan Altima. I would speak Spanish all the time, drink mojitos on the beach, and dance bachata with my brown-skinned father. I wonder what she's doing right now, that version of me. I wonder if she's happy. Thank you.
Graduate nonfiction winner Diane Neary with a series of vignettes excerpted from a larger work.
Woo!
Diane is a writer, journalist, and documentary filmmaker from New York City. Her feature stories and essays have appeared in New York Magazine, Elle, The New York Times, The Nation, The Earth Times, and elsewhere. She was the 2017 recipient of the Lillian Smith Writer in Service Award and won first prize in the 2017 Writer's Digest Annual Writing Competition. She has taught creative writing at Gadsden Correctional Facility since 2018. Tentatively entitled As If We Were Already Free, The Rise of the American Prison. The following are just two short vignettes about a pretty crucial legal turn that occurred in this country in 1980. November 18, 1988, Washington, D.C., the war on drugs. While president of the Screen Actors Guild 30 years ago, Ronald Reagan scoured Hollywood for communists. As president of the United States, he has hunted addicts, clearing them from street corners and flop houses in the bedrooms of their children. Just 8 weeks before leaving office, Reagan folds an amendment into his Anti-Drug Abuse Act, setting lifetime prison terms for various drug crimes. Under the amnesiac shroud of collective panic, the amendment passes without inquiry or backlash, demanding that even the smallest fish in a drug conspiracy be convicted for the actions of the surgeon. Reagan prefers his America the way he prefers his cocaine, decidedly white. Under the Act, a first-time offender will serve a minimum of 5 years if he is found in possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine. It will take 500 grams of the powder favored by college students and A-list celebrities to warrant the same sentence. In a televised address, the president appeals to former addicts, serviceable commodities in his war. You're the combat veterans, he says, and you have a critical role to play. You can help others by telling your story and providing a willing hand to those in need. He does not add that this storytelling will, for some of them, be imprisoned, as the new mandatory minimums foment the contagion of retroactive snitching. Submitted as technical corrections amendments, these almost invisible laws will come to alter the lives of millions. From the East Room of the White House, the president declares, "This bill helps us close rank on those who continue to provide drugs." Adopting the language of the revolutionary, Reagan calls DEA agents killed in the line of duty comrades in arms, attempting to occupy a dual role as inquisitor and insurgent. January 1989, Mobile, Alabama. Lula Mae Smith has spent years making other people's beds, has grown accustomed to being politely ignored as she scrubs away the messes. In nearly six decades on this earth, the Black Alabama native has scarcely known a day without work. Outside the Holiday Inn, where she is employed as a maid, Lula Mae finds an unlikely friend in Bob Clark, an attorney with an office next door. Seeking respite from the oppressive heat of the motel kitchen, she begins chatting with the lawyer at the open back door where she takes a break. The shock upending the life of Lula Mae begins not with a warrant for her son, a known drug dealer, but with the informant who fingers Lula Mae as a member of his crack cocaine ring. When her son skips town, prosecutor Willie Huntley makes a hostage of his mother, and Bob Clark acquires a new client. The conspiracy clause has tipped the playing field of drug prosecution, so the state may buy its best players with the currency of liberty, while defense attorneys are forced to play the game upside down. If I offered a witness a $100 bill to come and say it my way, I'd go to prison for that, rails Bob Clark. Yet the government can give them something far more precious than money. They can give them freedom. The trial of Lula Mae and her co-defendants lasts 14 days. As the jury recites the verdicts, the prosecutor hopes in vain that his command of the courtroom was not so masterful as to spell the old woman's exile. The closer we got to her name, the more I kept hoping, please let it say not guilty, Huntley admits. I kept getting closer, guilty, 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 and I pray a little harder, let them say not guilty. And they got to her name, and they said guilty too. Rules that bend for politicians break everybody else. As Lula is driven across state lines to a federal prison in a gated van for the lawlessness of a mother's love, the son of the President of the United States is snorting cocaine at Camp David, a pastime he has relished not once, his sister-in-law Sharon Bush affirms, but many times. Now the kindest eyes in Mobile fix their gaze from behind wire-frame lenses on a stained, oatmeal-colored sheet, its edges pulled taut against a thin prison-issued mattress. After her release, Lula will watch one of the men who cost her 7 years and two strokes stroll freely about the neighborhood. Perched on a rusty, wrought iron bench beside her front porch, deep gray tresses parting her hairline and deeper pockets enfolding her dark eyes, she points to the neighbor walking past in a blue t-shirt and black baseball cap. "There he goes," she says. "There the snitch goes. There he is." Bob Clark will never represent an informant. Costs himself dozens of clients this way. Do I feel that snitches lie? His mouth forms a rictus of disdain, only when I'm also moving. The prosecutor still insists he wished covertly for Lula's freedom, placing his fate in the hands of 12 strangers to unravel his own skillfully woven fallacies. "I hoped they would," he will say, years after her conviction. "But I guess I did too good a job." Thank you. Our undergraduate fiction winner is Erica Frederick for I Want So Much From This Life. Erica Frederick is a writer and student at Florida State University, graduating in 2018 with a degree in creative writing and psychology. I want to thank all my friends who came here to support me tonight. I went to Haiti this Christmas, and I wanted to write a story about the people I knew there and that I know here. This is I Want So Much From This Life. There's this verse in the Bible, and I'm sure this isn't how it goes. Sure, I had it remembered wrong since I remembered it, but it says that part of the earth is red because thousands of years ago, Mars was a comet. And it looped around us, turned time around, and rained red parts of itself here on Earth. Everything around here is red. All sienna clay and burgundy soil that ends full stop the red with rust near the new Alamokai sign that's an advertisement for a cell phone company. Daddy says this mountain is red because of war. Says this land is cursed with the blood of all the people we killed here. I think it's red because this is right where those pieces of Mars landed when it hit here. Right here, for us. I squat in the dirt in front of our house and its cracked foundation. My feet are flat on the ground and my bum is low. Something I watched Mummy become unable to do until one morning, without singing it in the morning like she always done, she just unbecame. I knew me and Daddy and everyone else in this life. I rolled an old perfume tube back and forth between my thumb and first finger. It scratched at every place it could be scratched, and each scratch is embedded with red that I know by now can never ever come out. I wrap the neck of the tube tightly with twine, loop it around so it's long enough to fit over someone's head and start wrapping up the other end. While I'm wrapping, I look up at those high northern mountains that can't belong to us. Can only really belong to those Haitians who aren't black. Those people who can't see here from there. You can't hardly see anyone who's small when you're big. I look down at my belly. It's stretching out the seams of this thin shirt. Every time Daddy plants an eye on it, he can't stop laughing. He'll call me a donkey and ask how I'm going to raise that thing when I don't even got a chest to feed it. I guess I don't know. I just want my baby to have everything, more than even this earth. I pick up the red dirt in pinches and fit it into the tiny opening of the tube. I can see the girl running a bow-legged toddler run. She doesn't know yet that she's got a planet around her neck. And when we own it, it's all hers. Thank you. Karen Tucker's fiction appears in Missouri Review, Epic, Tin House Online, American Literary Review, Cars Magazine, Salamander, and elsewhere. She serves as fiction editor in the Southeast Review and is pursuing a PhD in creative writing at Florida State. Groceries, or because your manager keeps following you around the restaurant saying you might not have such a crap schedule if you just go out for drinks with him once in a while. But guess what? The 3-pound glob of fat riding around in your skull works pretty much like every other human brain on the planet. It won't be long before that stuff comes in. Seriously, don't start. And if you do start, don't eat, snort, smoke, shoot, or boof and drive. I know a woman who nodded off, smashed into a utility pole outside the quick check, woke up to be a Narcan in an ambulance and was taken straight to county where she had to go through withdrawal and lockup. Another guy I know railed perks in his bedroom one night, decided he just had to have a 10-piece McNuggets, and ended up flipping his mom's cellophane. Dude walked away with nothing more than a nasty bruise on his shoulder thanks to Junkie Jesus, but the car was totaled, and of course his mom only had liability. A year later, she'd still taken the bus to work. If you decide to drive, for God's sakes, don't keep your stash in your glove box or your summer cold console. When you get pulled over, that's the first place they're checking. Even if they don't have probable, all they have to do is pretend they smell weed. And just like that, your vehicle's being searched and you're being felt at by a rubber glove deputy sheriff. Do yourself a favor and hide it in your fuse panel, in the overhead light fixture. Put it in one of those magnetic key boxes and stick it up under your rear bumper. Lutz always took out the padded inserts on her bras, which left a couple of handy pockets for storage that no one ever found, no matter how enthusiastically she was hoped. Now, I'm not sure this would get past a sniffer dog if it came down to it, but hey, she's never been busted. Then again, Lutz has always been lucky, for the most part. Don't steal your grandma's pain pills. It'll haunt you forever. Don't steal her fun, thin patches. Don't volunteer to drive her to a friend's house for their weekly cribbage tournament, ask if you can use the bathroom, and go through the medicine chest. Don't get mad at your grandma when she starts hiding her DeLonghi from you. Don't dig her through her garbage so you can smoke the used patches. Don't take her cash out of her purse. When she asks you about the missing dough, don't lie to her face and make her worry even more about her failing memory. Don't steal her ATM card and make her and try out your birthday for the password. She loves you so much that it will work. When she dies, will 1010 feel like a piece of shit for having been the worst kind of grandkid imaginable? But even if it hurts so bad you think you might pass out, definitely don't leave her funeral early and hurry back to her apartment and search her bedroom until you find her meds hidden in the lining of her winter parka. You'll end up sharing that story at meetings for years, and it'll never get easier. If you can quit now, do. Don't say dumb shit over text. Ask if the tickets are still available. If they can hang, if you can pay them $100 you owe them. Don't fuck people over. Always pay your debts. Don't wear good clothes or sit on a nice couch if you're a smoker, because when you nod, they wake up to find burn holes in the fabric. Don't ignore your gut. Take off if something feels sketchy. Keep your eyes open. Never let your money walk. It's true that junkie Jesus will sometimes help out if you need it. I can't tell you how many people I know who have been sweating and feverish and almost doubled over with pain, and then they look on the ground and find a legit OC80 just waiting for someone to come along and eat it. A Ziploc of Roxy's, a strip of H215 still in the blister pack. Once, Luce and I were so sick, we thought we were going to die right there at the Chevron. Of course, the rain wouldn't stop, and none of the regulars were around, and no one was answering tax money, and the shady middles, or the dudes who took pleasure ripping girls off. When the cashier, a stocky redhead named Charlene, who used to babysit me when I was in kindergarten, came out and said she was going to call the cops if we didn't get a move on. My bowels cramped up so bad I thought I was going to poop my pants like a little kid. And then in rolls this beat-up Volvo 240. Same exact year as Luce's, only this one is midnight blue instead of green, and a girl with candy pink hair and a weirdly cool chambray jumpsuit climbs out and starts filling the tank. Her head bobbing in time with some private interior music. She also has this giant corduroy purse she has close to her body instead of leaving it in the front seat like most people, and this is what tips us off. We go up to her, and Luce asks if we could maybe get directions. Directions to where exactly? Luce doesn't say. The girl flicks her eyes over our gray, sweaty faces, and then she tells us to hold on a sec because she has to pee like a mother. Goes inside, comes out a few minutes later, hands us a plastic sack. Got you a couple Gatorades, some sour Skittles. You're in a little extra something on me. A get-well treat, you could call it. She slides into a car and goes zooming off into the distance. At the bottom of the bag are half dozen of hens. Junkie Jesus for the woman. If your plug tells you it's so strong that dudes are falling out all over, listen to her. If the pill looks faded or crumbly, if the numbers are blurry, or if the glitter isn't tight in the corners, do a test thought no bigger than a match head. Chances are it's been pressed. If you're trying not to use, don't go on Reddit opiates and look at the dope porn, because it'll just make you drool and put you at risk for slipping. If you need a cold cop, buy a small amount at first so you're not out a lot of dough if it ends up being trash. If you get shorted, say something. I mean, you don't have to be a dick about it, but stand up for yourself so you don't get keep taken advantage of. If you decide the game has got too exhausting, too stupid, that it costs too much, or it gives you a whole bunch of nothing or worse in return, maybe go to a meeting and see what happens. Just for today. If you're sick and no one's answering, JJ has also been known to work as miracles on Craigslist. Look for listings under roofing tar or misconnections in Roxy. Also, some folks swear by the DNM. Install Tor, get some BTC, localbitcoins.com, and check Reddit Darknet Markets for a good offset guide, and the names of some reliable vendors. Although Luce and I really never got into that scene, even when we're flailing around in the snake pit, I'm told the quality can be off the charts fantastic, and you can find a rare stuff that you'd never be able to get from your local weed girl. Then again, now that the feds have been seizing markets, I hear it's turning into a real cluster. Nothing's as easy as it used to be. Still, imagine a package just showing up at your doorstep. You never even have to leave the house if you didn't want to. Which, of course, is also risky. If you're still able to get out of the game, try it. Make sure you and your friends know how to have an Narcan and know how to use it. If you can't wake someone, or if they're breathing slow or shallow and their eyes are pinned, they might be in serious trouble. Call 911, stick the tip of the device into one of their nostrils, press down on the plunger. Sometimes you have to administer repeated doses before they regain consciousness. They also be aware that it basically puts the recipient into instant painful withdrawal, so don't be surprised if they start howling in anguish. After a little time has passed, they'll be grateful that you were around to revive them, but in the moment they'll think they're about to go meet the great dealer in the sky. And since you can never predict when someone you know will slip after an extra crack night at work followed by drinks with a pervert manager, or after a surprise visit from your mom during which an entire weekend's worth of tips vanishes out of their bag, or if you'll happen upon a stranger sitting outside a food line in a dented green Volvo slumped against the dashboard circling the drain, you'll want to keep a box of the spray in your purse or backpack. There's a real crisis going on out there. Take it from a former high school mathlete whose best friend was almost snatched right off the planet not so long ago. The real junkie Jesus equals Mark Hamill with someone to give it to you. Too long to read. For fuck's sake, don't start if you haven't already. If you have, be safe and happy now, too. Thanks.